just hold your finger there at the Bible passage. We'll get there in a little bit.
There we go. Sorry, my bad. All right. On the northern edge of the land of Israel, about 3 miles west of the ancient city of Dan, lie the remains of a town built by a cave. It's a place of natural beauty. Snow-capped Mount Hermon is to the north. The area is green, lush from the plentiful water coming from the mountain. The highest waterfall in Israel is here. The source of the water is a large spring, not far from the mouth of the cave. 1,000 years ago, the water flowed directly from the cave itself, but several catastrophic earthquakes have caused a section of the cave roof to collapse, filling the cave floor with debris and causing the spring to surface a few hundred yards away. But the cave is imposing even in its current state. You can see on the front edge of the cave where the roof collapsed from the earthquakes. You can see the scarring from that in the rocks. But what a sight this cave must have been before the earthquakes. Josephus, the first century Jewish historian, describes it this way, quote, "The place is called Panium or Panias or Banias in modern Arabic. The place is called Panium," Josephus writes, "where is a top of a mountain that is raised to an immense height, and at its side, beneath or at its bottom, a dark cave opens itself, within which there is a horrible precipice that descends abruptly to a vast depth. It contains a mighty quantity of water which is immovable, and when anybody lets down anything to measure the depth of the earth beneath the water, no length of cord is sufficient to reach it." In other words, the cave floor dropped off immediately under the water, and they didn't have any way, any instruments or ropes capable of measuring how far down that water went, how deep it was. So it seemed to the ancients that this was a sacred place and a fearful place, a place where fearful spirits ought to be worshipped. Well, when Alexander the Great and his Greek armies conquered their way through this area and saw this cave, they were in awe. Surely this was a gate of Hades, an entrance to the underworld, for they believed that the gods and the dead, the departed spirits, lived in the underworld, and that watery caves were primary places of entrance, of passage between the two worlds. So surely this cave was a gate of Hades. So the Greeks built shrines and set up idols, and the area became even more a center for pagan worship than it had previously been. The Canaanites had worshipped Baal here, probably called Baal Hermon after the mountain just to the north. But the Greeks introduced a new god, Pan, the god of the forests, the god of flocks, the god of shepherds. Pan was half man and half goat. He was also believed to bring fertility. Also, he was believed to cause panic. In fact, our word panic comes from his name. He caused panic at night, delighting in causing the herds to stampede or filling people with senseless terror. Having Pan on your side was useful in battle because he could cause panic in the armies of your enemies and help you to win. As I said, he was also believed to bring fertility, and as was common in pagan fertility cults, sexual perversion and the celebration of raw passion was core to the worship of Pan. And so people traveled from all over the Greek world to worship at the mouth of the cave and to participate in the dancing, the parties, and the orgies that went along with that worship. Sacrifices were thrown into the cave. Why would anybody think it was a good idea to throw something dead into your water supply? That just seems really disgusting to me. But sacrifices were thrown into the cave, and this is printed on signs in front of the cave. It's now a nature preserve that you can go visit if you get the chance to go to Israel. Sacrifices were thrown into the cave, and if the sacrifice disappeared, Pan had accepted the sacrifice. If blood or any other trace of the sacrifice surfaced on the water, then Pan had rejected the sacrifice. Well, it was here at this center for pagan worship that Herod the Great's son Philip built his capital for the portion of his father's kingdom that he had inherited. And he named his newly renovated city Caesarea after Tiberius Caesar, who was his benefactor and his friend. But since there was already a famous city named Caesarea down along the Mediterranean coast, Philip's capital became known as Caesarea Philippi. There was a small Jewish community in the area, it seems, but the majority of the inhabitants were a mixture of Greek and Canaanite. And in addition to the wild orgies associated with the worship of Pan, there was a large temple for worshiping Caesar, the Roman emperor. Herod Philip had built a great palace for himself, and many statues, idols of Greek gods and goddesses, were donated by wealthy citizens and placed in niches carved into the face of the cliff near the cave of Pan. And some of those niches still survive today, even with their inscriptions saying who donated this idol and what the idol was of. Pious Jewish rabbis, especially the Galilean rabbis, taught that this wicked city should be avoided. There was even a teaching among the rabbis that the gates of Hades, or this pagan worship site at Caesarea Philippi, there was a teaching that these gates of Hades would fall when the Messiah came. Now, if you'll recall the last few messages we looked at from the Gospel of Matthew, you'll remember that Jesus had left the Jewish areas for some solitude and for things to calm down. As Jesus returned from there, he fed the 4,000. Then he came back to his home area of Galilee and was once again greeted with the cynicism and rejection of the Pharisees. He warned his disciples to beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the Herodians, or to watch out for their twisted religion and their corrupt politics. And then, once again, he took his disciples on a journey out of the country, or almost out of the country, this time north to that center of pagan wickedness, Caesarea Philippi. Why would he take them there? There were so many wicked things there that could defile a Jew. A proper rabbi would teach his followers to stay away from such wicked places. Jesus took his disciples directly to the wicked city. Now, the Bible only states that Jesus went to the coasts of Caesarea Philippi. That is, he went to the general area. We don't know for sure whether or not they went into the city and toured the pagan temples. But the conversation that takes place here between Jesus and his disciples takes on new meaning when it's set in this context, the context of this picture here. And Ray Vanderlaan places the conversation on a hillside overlooking the temples in this cave and draws some powerful points from that. And some of the thoughts in this message are credit from his research on this site. So let's read the first verse of our text this morning, Matthew 16, verse 13. When Jesus came into the region of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, saying, "Who do men say that I, the Son of Man, am?" This is recorded by Matthew, by Mark, and Luke. Luke notes that this conversation began when Jesus was praying alone. We know Jesus often went to the hills at night or early in the morning to pray. And it seems that this is what he has done here again. And so the disciples find him in the morning, probably on a hillside overlooking the cave of Pan and the heathen temples and palaces. And as Jesus is finishing praying, the disciples draw near. They gather around him. And he rises from his prayer and greets them by asking this question: "Who do people say that the Son of Man is?" It's a leading question. Jesus wasn't asking because he didn't know the answer. He was setting them up to teach them something. And so, verse 14. So they said, "Some say John the Baptist, some Elijah, and others Jeremiah or one of the prophets." Well, the answer to Jesus' question was obvious. It wasn't a trick question. They simply answered, "Some say you're John the Baptist." Herod Antipas even thought this. He figured that Jesus did the miracles that he did because he was John the Baptist come back to life. Some say you are Elijah. This belief, I think, was common among the peoples of Galilee, who believed that Jesus was a fulfillment of the prophecy of Malachi, who had been the last prophet to bring the word of the Lord. Some say, they said, that you are Jeremiah. I don't think this was quite as common of a belief, but apparently, I imagine it was Jews from the south, thought that Jesus was Jeremiah was the last great prophet before the destruction of Solomon's temple and the Babylonian captivity. And apparently some people thought that Jesus fit more with the image of the weeping prophet, Jeremiah, than with the fiery, passionate Elijah. And some say you were one of the other prophets. Those people saw Jesus as special, but maybe more as a curiosity than as a fulfillment of one of the great prophecies. Verse 15. He said to them, "But who do you say that I am?" It's a direct question. There was no dodging it. There's no way to hedge your bets or try to take a middle road here. And it was an important question at the time. John, in his gospel, the end of chapter 6, records that at this time, many of Jesus' followers went back and quit following him. They abandoned him. Jesus had begun teaching, and this is, again, the end of John chapter 6. John places this conversation, I think, more at the end of the feeding of the 5,000. Excuse me. John records Jesus teaching that he was the bread from heaven, that he was the real manna, that what the Israelites ate in the wilderness back in the old days was just a foretaste. Jesus was the real bread from heaven, and he said if a person would truly live, he must eat the flesh of Jesus and drink the blood of Jesus. And they said, "This is a hard saying, teacher. Who can receive it?" And more of his once enthusiastic followers wrote him off as a bust and went back to their normal lives. And Jesus asked the 12, "Will you also go away?" Who do you say that I am? Jesus had been popular, but now his popularity was fading. He had seemed on the path to political victory, but now he was being rejected and essentially driven out of the country. Jesus had been a brilliant teacher, but now he was saying things that sounded downright insane. Who do you say that I am? Your answer reveals what you're going to do. Are you going to go away because the teachings are getting hard to receive? Are you going to go away because the powers that be are hunting you and things are getting dangerous? Are you going to go away because the crowds are mocking you and your teacher? Who do you say that I am? Not only is it a direct question, it is a directed question. The emphasis in the wording is on you. But you, who do you say that I am? Jesus is pointing the question directly at each one of the disciples individually. He's also pointing the question at you. Who do you say that I am? Verse 16, Simon Peter answered and said, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." Peter is very clear in his answer and he's very specific. The article, the one. In English, it shows up three times in that verse. You are the Christ, the Son of the living God. But in the Greek, it's there four times and it's even more direct and more specific. Jesus is the Christ. He's the Messiah, the anointed one, the only one. Now, Peter, along with Andrew, Philip, and Nathaniel, had believed this about Jesus from the very moment John the Baptist introduced them to Jesus. You can read about that in John chapter 1. Jesus is the Christ. Jesus is the Son. He is God's only begotten, born not of a human father, but the very Son of God himself. He is the Son. The only one. Jesus is the Son of the God. There is only one God. There may be countless demons and idols. There may be a never-ending stream of emperors and rulers demanding worship, but there is only one God, and Jesus is his son. And fourthly, Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of the God, the Living One. The Living One. Emperors die, idols crumble into dust, but the God lives. He is eternally alive. He is the very source of life itself. Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the God, the Living One. And Peter speaks the answer, but he is speaking for the 12. They are all in agreement here. Will you go away? No. And John records Peter saying, to whom shall we go? You have the words of life, and we have come to believe and know that you are the Christ. And Jesus responds to Peter, verse 17. Jesus answered and said to him, blessed are you, Simon Barjona, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. And I also say to you that you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it. And I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. Then he commanded his disciples that they should tell no one that he was the Christ. Blessed are you. Peter gets his own beatitude. This special blessing was directed at Peter, but it extends to everyone who, with Peter, answers this most important question, as Peter did. Blessed are you because flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. You did not come up with this on your own. There is no way that a human mind could come to this confidence. You say this because it was revealed to you by my Father which is in heaven. Paul would later write, no one can say Jesus is Lord except by the Holy Spirit. 1 Corinthians 12:3. Or John, much later, wrote, every spirit that confesses that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh is from God. 1 John 4:2. Or as Jesus himself said several times in John 6, no one can come to me unless the Father who sent me draws him. Anybody could say the words. The crowds could speculate about who Jesus was. But the kind of faith that Peter had, the confidence of his proclamation, is only possible in a person if it is placed there by God. Our faith to believe that Jesus is the Son of God, our confidence to confess Jesus as Lord, is only possible if God draws us and God puts the faith in us. God initiates our believing in him. God takes the first step of our salvation. Faith is not possible unless God plants it. Jesus continues, and I tell you, you are Peter. Now, Jesus had first answered Peter's confession by using his official full name, Simon, Jonah's son. And when Jesus first met Simon, this is in John 1:42, he said, you shall be called Cephas, or Peter. Cephas is Aramaic. Peter is Greek. When you move names from one language to another, usually you transliterate the name. That is, you create a word in the new language that sounds as much as you can like the name did in the old language. And so Petros, which is what Peter was in Greek, gets transliterated to Peter in English. But sometimes when the meaning of the name is what's important, they don't transliterate the name, make it sound the same. They translate it. They keep the meaning the same. And that's what happened. Jesus called Simon Cephas in Aramaic, which means stone. And because the meaning was what was significant, as he moved into the Greek-speaking world, as his ministry progressed, the name became Peter, which was the Greek word for it. And it's in Greek that it's recorded here in Matthew. Though Jesus very almost certainly was speaking Aramaic to the disciples. But Cephas the rock became Peter the rock as he moved into the Greek-speaking world. You are Peter, he says, and upon this rock I will build my church. Now what's Jesus saying here? This it's a word picture or even a pun. This pun on Peter's nickname has caused no end of controversy in the years since. Was Jesus saying that he would build the church on Peter, the man? As in, you're the rock and on this rock I'm going to build my church? Well, there is some truth to that understanding. Not to the extent that it's taken to by the Roman Catholic Church, though. But Peter and the other apostles were indeed the foundation stones of the church. In fact, if you read Revelation 21, the description of the holy city, the New Jerusalem, verse 14 says that the wall of the holy city, the wall of the New Jerusalem, has 12 foundations, and on those foundations are inscribed the names of the 12 apostles. So the holy city, heaven as we think of it, is built, our eternal abode of the church is built on the rocks of the 12 apostles. That is literally what Revelation 21:14 says. On this rock. The typical Protestant church interpretation of this passage is that Jesus was saying that the rock on which he would build the church is the confession. You're Peter, you're the rock, and on this rock, on your confession that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, on this rock, on that confession, I will build my church. And there is a subtle difference in the Greek language that lends itself to this idea. Because when Jesus said, you are Peter, the Greek word is Petros, which means usually a stone or a boulder. When he said, on this rock I will build my church, the Greek word there is Petra, not Petros. Petra usually meaning a cliff or a bedrock. So in this understanding, Peter is the little rock. Some commentators go so far as to say Petros always was a rock that was small enough to be able to be thrown by a man, though I did not find that argument convincing. So Peter is the little rock, and it's on this giant rock, the Petra, the bedrock, that I will build my church. That is the confession of faith. And there's some value in that understanding as well. But remember, Jesus was almost certainly speaking Aramaic, not Greek. And Aramaic doesn't have the distinction between the different kinds of rocks. The word's just Cephas, rock, for the whole spectrum. So that wrinkle in the language probably wasn't there in actually what Jesus said. So what did he mean? Again, credit to Ray Vanderlaan for this interpretation. What did Jesus mean when he used this imagery here at Caesarea Philippi with the disciples? Well, remember where they were. Jesus, as he often did, is speaking in pictures, word pictures. He takes the things that they're seeing, the things in front of them, uses those as visuals to teach his lesson. A parable, if you will. The parable of the sower. As they see a person sowing seed, Jesus can use that and draw a parable from it. As they see a patch in a garment, Jesus can lift that and use the patch as a parable. And that's what he does with the rock here. You're Peter, you're the rock, and on this rock, the cliff, the cave, the rock right in front of them, on this rock, I will build my church. It's on this rock, housing that creepy cave where all the nasty stuff was done. It's on this rock, this one right here, that I will build my church. I will set my foundation at the very seat of idolatry and wickedness. I will build my church in the most depraved places, in the strongholds of Satan, and the gates of Hades will not prevail against it. No amount of spiritual darkness will have any power against the church. No amount of evil or sin will overcome the church. No fear or panic has any power against the church of Christ. Remember again where they are. The cave, considered to be a gate of Hades, the home of Pan, the god of panic. And he says, I will give you the keys to the kingdom of heaven. Now, was Jesus giving Peter power to forgive sins, power to absolve, power that could be passed on from one pope to the next and from one priest to the next? That's a leap that the Roman Catholic Church has made. But I think the more likely meaning was more of rabbinic, Jewish rabbi language. When a rabbi loosed something, he allowed it. And when he bound something, he forbade it. Your rabbi bound something, you as his follower were no longer permitted to do that. If your rabbi loosed something, it was allowed. Well, I'm not willing to apply that to modern man-made church rules. I'm not quite ready to make that leap either. There's some similarity there as well. But what I really think about these words is this. I will give you the keys. So we're talking about gates. The imagery is gates and doors. The gates of Hades, where the gods, the demons, allowed things to move back and forth. He says, I'll build my church, the kingdom of heaven. The gates of Hades are not going to prevail against it, and I'm going to give you the keys. I'm going to give you the keys to the kingdom of heaven. Peter and the other apostles and every believer who follows in their footsteps has the privilege, has the authority to invite others to step in the kingdom of heaven, to proclaim the gospel to them, to tell the story of Jesus, to invite them to confess that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and by so doing, to unlock the door to the kingdom of heaven and invite them in. I am giving you the authority to proclaim this gospel and to open the gate of the kingdom of heaven, even in the darkest places, and invite people in. The key to the kingdom of heaven, on this understanding, is the authority to proclaim the good news of salvation. And then Jesus strictly charged the disciples to tell no one that he was the Christ. It was just too dangerous at this point. If Jesus allowed public verification of his true identity at this point in time, it would have almost certainly led to a civil war. The common people in Galilee would have risen up behind him and fought for him to be their king. The Jewish leaders, along with the Romans, would have fought against them. Civil war. It was too dangerous. So he charged them to tell no one that he was the Christ. Let's keep reading. Verse 21. From that time, Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed and be raised the third day. Then Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him, saying, Far be it from you, Lord. This shall not happen to you. But he turned and said to Peter, Get behind me, Satan. You are an offense to me, for you are not mindful of the things of God, but the things of men. So now that the rock-solid faith foundation was established and was clearly communicated, Jesus began to explain to them his true purpose, his true mission. The Christ would not lead an army. The Christ would be abused by an army. The Christ would not occupy the temple. The Christ would be rejected by the temple leaders. The Christ would not conquer. The Christ would be conquered. He would suffer and would die. But he would be raised again on the third day. And Peter, probably made bold by the big pat on the back he'd just gotten from Jesus, pulled Jesus aside and tried to correct him. He rebuked him. Not so. May it never be, Lord. This shall never happen to you. See, Peter knew who Jesus was, but he did not understand who Jesus was. He knew that Jesus was the Messiah, but he didn't understand what it meant to be the Messiah. And really, how could he have understood? And yet, how could he have thought it a good idea to rebuke the Christ, the Son of the living God? But that's exactly what he did. And as he did, tried to privately pull Jesus aside and quietly correct him, Jesus turned. And Mark, who almost certainly got his details from Peter himself, Mark vividly depicts Jesus turning his back on Peter and loudly speaking to the rest of the disciples, Get behind me, Satan. For you are not mindful of the things of God, but the things of men. He said, you are a hindrance to me, or literally, you are a scandalon, is the Greek word, a stumbling block. Still using the imagery of stones. Whereas you are the rock, and on this rock I will build my church. Now he says, you are a stumbling block. You are an out of place rock in the middle of the pathway, causing people to trip and fall. How quickly he went from being a foundation stone to being a stumbling stone. His pride and his own understanding moved him to become an obstacle in the path. And Jesus saw in Peter's words, in his rebuke, the echoes of Satan's temptation in the wilderness when Satan said, I will give you all the kingdoms of the world if you will bow down and worship me. You see, with those words, Satan tried to entice Jesus to avoid the cross and to receive his rightful kingdom another way. Now, Peter didn't have kingdoms to offer the way that Satan did, but he had his own strength. He had his own abilities. And the way he saw it, there was no need for Jesus to suffer. They'd work together. They'd find a way. The crowds would once again be swayed to support Jesus, and the promised kingdom would come. And it greatly angered Jesus to hear Satan's words coming from the mouth of his dear friend Peter. And yet, despite Jesus' harsh rebuke of Peter here, their friendship remained strong. Exactly 1 week after this, Jesus would take Peter, along with James and John, to a very special place, where they would witness the glory of Jesus in a way that no other living person would while Jesus was here on earth. But that's another story for another time. Jesus said to Peter, you are not setting your mind on the things of God, but on the things of man. And that makes me ask the question, what am I setting my mind on? What are you setting your mind on? Verse 24. Then Jesus said to his disciples, if anyone desires to come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever desires to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. For what profit is it to a man if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul? Or what will a man give in exchange for his soul? For the Son of Man will come in the glory of his Father with his angels, and then he will reward each according to his works. If any man will come after me, let him do three things. Let him deny himself. This is a word, it's an imperative, it's a command, but it's a word with immediacy. Do it now. This is what you must do if you want to come after him. You cannot come after Jesus if you cling to yourself. You must deny yourself. Lay down your own load which you've been carrying, so you will have capacity to take up the load that Jesus requires you to carry. Let him deny himself. Let him take up his cross. Pick it up right now. Do it at once. The decision to come after Jesus is in front of you, requiring an immediate answer. Jesus does not want hesitant followers. He wants immediate action. And let him follow me. Unlike the first two commands, which were actions to be done at once, this third requirement is an ongoing, a continual action. Once you have denied yourself, once you have taken up your cross, then you are called to continually, moment by moment, follow Jesus. To go where he goes, to do what he says, to love as he loves, to lay down your life as he laid down his life. For whoever would save his life will lose it. Save his life, that is, save it from the cross, save it from loss, save the sense of self, the sense of control. And this is a key difference between the one who minds the things of God. Remember, Jesus said, Peter, you're not minding the things of God, you're minding the things of man. The one who minds the things of God and the one who minds the things of man, there's a key difference. If you set your mind on the things of man, you will naturally and instinctively try to save your life. You'll act and react out of a drive to protect yourself, to prevent loss of possessions, to protect against pain, to preserve your own dreams and desires. The one who sets his mind on the things of man will try to save his life, which results ultimately in him losing his life. But whoever loses his life for my sake and for the gospel's sake, some of the other writers record Jesus saying, will find it. The one who loses his life, that is, loses his possessions, who gives up his dreams and desires, who suffers real pain, who maybe even dies a martyr's death. And you know, many of Jesus' original followers literally lost their lives. They paid the ultimate price for following Jesus. And they did this because they chose to set their minds on the things of God. Minding the things of God led them to lose everything, which resulted in their lives being found, being eternally saved. And then Jesus asked two questions with obvious answers. What does it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul? You know, Jesus could have himself could have gained the whole world if he had lost his soul, if he had given his soul away. That's what Satan was offering in that temptation when he said, "All these things will I give you if you will bow down and worship me." But Jesus knew that the value of a soul is immensely more than the value of anything or things in the world. Because the things of the world, whatever they are, they're temporary. They'll pass away, they'll rot, they'll rust, they'll crumble. But the soul is eternal. What could be worth trading for a soul? Obviously nothing. The soul is eternal, and it is the eternal soul that will face the judgment of the Son of Man. And here, at the end of the teaching, Jesus returns to this title for himself, the Son of Man that he started with. The Son of Man, he says, is going to come with his angels in the glory of his Father, and he will repay each person according to what he has done. And it is this judgment, it is in light of this judgment that it makes sense to deny yourself, take up your cross, and follow Jesus. It's in light of that coming judgment that it makes sense to lose your life for Christ's sake and for the sake of the gospel. Because it's through that path that you will ultimately find your life. That through that path you will hear at the judgment the words, "Well done, my good and faithful servant. Enter into the joy of your Lord." In this statement of Jesus, Mark adds these sobering words, Mark 8:38. "For whoever is ashamed of me and of my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of him will the Son of Man also be ashamed when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels." Jesus commanded his disciples to build the church in the darkest places, to lay its foundations hard against the very gates of Hades. And he commands us today to build his church in the middle of a crooked and perverse generation. And this comes at a great cost to those who follow Jesus. At the cost of comfort, at the cost of possessions, at the cost of reputation, sometimes even at the cost of life itself. It's only in our confident confession of the divinity, the reality, and the authority of Jesus that we can find strength to bear up under the weight of the cross to which he calls us. And if we waver in that confession, if we are ashamed of Jesus in this adulterous and sinful generation, then when the time comes that we stand before the Son of Man and his angels to be judged for what we have done, he will be ashamed of us. Sobering. So what about you? Have you, with Peter, confessed that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God? Have you set your mind on the things of God? Or are you setting your mind on the things of man? Are you denying yourself and taking up your cross? Are you boldly taking your place with Jesus? Or are you ashamed of him? Yes, you will be judged by Christ and his angels for the things you have done. And yes, it is a serious offense to be ashamed of Jesus. If this thought makes you discouraged and fearful, remember the story of Peter, the rock. In Jesus' darkest hour, what did Peter do? As Jesus was captured by the Jewish authorities and was being condemned to death, was Peter ashamed of Jesus? Yes, he was. He was so ashamed of him that he lied, saying that he never even knew Jesus. He was so intensely ashamed of Jesus that he swore an oath that he had never known Jesus. What happened to Peter after this? Was he harshly judged for his awful failing? No, he was forgiven. He was restored not only to a place of acceptance by Jesus, he was restored to his place of leadership. He was restored to being a pillar, being a foundation stone upon which the church would be built. And Jesus even predicted that this denial would happen. He said, but when you are restored, strengthen your brethren. So, yes, there are times when we falter in our faith. There will be times when you will be ashamed of Jesus. But don't be afraid. There is forgiveness. Return to Jesus. Look to his face and see in his eyes the love and forgiveness that he longs to pour over you. Return and boldly take your stand with Jesus again. Proclaim that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God. Take the keys to the kingdom of heaven that he is giving you and invite anyone and everyone to believe in Jesus Christ and so enter the kingdom. Let's pray.